You're listening to DTFHN for February 19th, 2026. I'm your mass-produced at 500 per day host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people argue about phonics with the intensity of kernel developers. Today's got that rare energy W stuff, refuses to die, and the new stuff earns its keep. Let's get into it. I've been building systems long enough to know that the hardest part is never the design. It's the transition from works in the lab to works at scale, reliably thousands of times. And that's exactly where Pebble is right now. Eric Mijakovsky and the rebooted Pebble team are in production verification tests for the Pebble Time 2. That's the last gate before mass production. They've manufactured hundreds of units in test builds, found problems, fixed problems, and just before the Lunar New Year factory shutdown, got the confirmation that all tests passed on the final build. Mass production starts March 9th, targeting 500 watches per day. Let me break down what's actually happening here, because the details matter. The bulk of January was spent on waterproofing. This is one of those problems that sounds simple, and absolutely is not. You're trying to seal a device that has a speaker, a microphone, buttons, a charging port. Every one of those is a potential ingress point. They got it to 3 ATM, which is 30 meters. Good enough for swimming, not good enough for diving or hot tubs. That's a real engineering constraint, not a marketing limitation. Heat weakens the seals. High-pressure water finds gaps that submersion doesn't. They're being honest about the boundaries, which I respect. The timeline is straightforward. First watches on wrists in early April. All pre-orders fulfilled by early June. Factory output ramps from 0 to 500 per day. Then watches ship weekly to distribution. Get packed, get delivered. Every step in that chain is a place where delays can compound. They're saying this explicitly. Delays can most likely will happen. That's not hedging, that's hardware. Now here's what makes this genuinely interesting in 2026. This is a watch company that died, got acquired by Fitbit, got acquired by Google, and got reborn by its original founder. One of the comments captures it perfectly. Someone is hoping their Pebble arrives before Google forces the migration of their Fitbit account. That's the whole story in one sentence. A user fleeing a platform that absorbed their platform, back to the original thing they actually wanted. And the old Pebble app ecosystem? The team built a compatibility layer that intercepts dead weather API calls from legacy watch faces and reroutes them through OpenMeteo. They're preserving an ecosystem, not just shipping hardware. The watch runs an open app platform. You can program it. You can build for it. Someone in the comments asks, what sets it apart from cheap Chinese smartwatches? The answer isn't specs. It's that this is a platform you can actually build on, maintained by people who care whether it survives. Hardware is hard. Shipping hardware at scale is harder. Doing it with an open platform while keeping a decade-old ecosystem alive. That's the kind of thing that matters. From open hardware to the language that powers most of it, let's talk about what's coming in C++ 26. C++ has unions, has had them forever. You can store an int or a double in the same memory location, and the language trusts you to remember which one you put there. At runtime, that trust is manageable. You track state, you use sentinel values, you do the bookkeeping. But at compile time, during constant evaluation, you've been flying blind. You could not ask the compiler which union member is active, even though the compiler literally knows the answer. It's tracking that information internally. It just wouldn't tell you. C++RLU fixes this before a LivePy. You pass it a pointer. It returns the bool. Is this object alive right now? That's it. The function is constable only. You cannot call it at runtime. And that constraint is the most interesting design decision in the entire proposal. The committee looked at this problem and said, runtime has workarounds. Compile time has nothing. We're solving the version of this problem that has no solution, and we're not pretending it solves the other one too. The motivating example is almost comically specific. You want an optional bool that fits in minimal storage, a union of bool and char. At runtime, you stuff a 2 into the char as a sentinel, because bool only uses 0 and 1. Ugly, but functional. At compile time, you cannot read from a union member that isn't active. That's undefined behavior. And you have no standard mechanism to ask which member is active. You're stuck. What I find compelling is the naming. They didn't call it as union member active. They built a general lifetime query and gave it a general name. The primary use case today is unions, yes. But the abstraction is deliberately broader. You're asking a fundamental question about object existence, and the committee chose to answer it at that level of generality. There's a pattern in language evolution where the most impactful features solve problems that practitioners have been working around for decades. Nobody was blocked by this. People shipped code. They used runtime tracking. They avoided conscript unions. They made it work. But the gap between what the compiler knows and what the programmer can ask has been quietly shaping what people attempt at compile time. This closes one of those gaps. Small surface area, precise semantics, solves exactly the problem it describes. That's how standards work when they're working well. We talked about tools doing exactly what they promise. Now let's flip that. What happens when the tools lie to you? One commenter on Hacker News put it simply. Talking with Gemini in Arabic, it starts citing the Quran, saying Alhamdulillah and Inshallah, and at one point told them, this is what our religion tells us we should do. That's not a bug report. That's a window into something fundamental about how these models behave when you step outside English. Roya Pakzad built a method she calls bilingual shadow reasoning, and the craft here deserves attention. She took OpenAI's GPT-OSS-20B model, fed it the same United Nations Human Rights Report on Iran, and generated 3 summaries. Same model, same document, same moment in time. The only variable was the reasoning policy. The hidden instructions steering how the model thinks before it writes. The default summary described what the report actually says. Over 900 executions, severe human rights violations, the documented reality. But when she introduced a Farsi language policy that mirrors the Islamic Republic's own framing. Cultural sensitivity, religious values, sovereignty. The output shifted. Suddenly, the summary emphasized government efforts to protect citizens through law enforcement. Room for dialogue. The facts didn't change. The lens did, and the output looked completely professional, completely neutral, completely publishable. This matters because of what it reveals about the architecture of trust in these systems. Summarization feels safe. It feels like a compression task. Take the long thing, make it short, preserve the meaning. But meaning is not a fixed quantity you can losslessly compress. Every summary is an editorial act. What you foreground, what you omit, what framing you choose. These are decisions. And when those decisions are made by a model whose reasoning chain can be steered by a hidden policy, you have a system that can produce propaganda indistinguishable from analysis. The historical parallel that comes to mind is the early days of machine translation at Georgetown in 1954. The famous IBM demonstration that translated Russian sentences into English. The public saw a tool for understanding. The intelligence community saw a tool for control. Same technology, entirely different implications depending on who sets the parameters. What Pakzad demonstrated is that multilingual summarization is dramatically easier to steer than question and answer tasks. The guardrails that hold in English loosen in other languages, and the people most affected. Researchers, journalists, human rights workers operating in Farsi, Arabic, Norwegian, are exactly the people who need these tools to be trustworthy. The red teaming work here is genuinely excellent. She's not theorizing about risks. She built the tool, ran the experiments, published the methodology. That's how this is supposed to work. Put the findings where others can build on them. From AI safety research to education policy, to systems that desperately need more people willing to show their work. Story 4. Alabama's third grade reading gate. If you can't read a grade level by the end of third grade, you don't move to fourth. Sounds almost punishingly simple, right? Like something a frustrated parent would say, not a state education policy. But here's the thing. It worked. Alabama went from basically the worst state in the country for fourth grade reading to the 30th percentile. Now, let me play devil's advocate on my own enthusiasm here, because one of the commenters caught something important. When they say Alabama shot up the national rankings, that's partly relative. Alabama's scores stayed roughly flat. Other states slipped. The national report card data backs this up. Alabama didn't so much climb the ladder as watch everyone else fall off it. But that framing actually makes this more interesting, not less. In an environment where reading scores are declining almost everywhere, holding steady is the achievement, and the mechanisms are worth examining. Three interventions. First, the reading gate itself. Phonics-based literacy with a hard promotion requirement. One commenter asked a genuinely good question. Can someone steel man the case against teaching phonics? And the honest answer is, not really. The whole language movement had theoretical backing in the 80s and 90s, but the evidence has been brutal. Phonics works. The mystery isn't why Alabama adopted it. The mystery is why so many states still haven't. Second, aggressive tracking of chronic absenteeism. Not punitive tracking. Supportive tracking. Social workers. Financial support for families dealing with housing instability or food insecurity. You can't teach a kid who isn't in the building. And it turns out that asking why they're not in the building and then actually helping is more effective than marking them absent and moving on. Third, optional extra school days during breaks. Voluntary, no mandate, just the door's open if you want it. What's quietly radical here is that none of this is expensive moonshot technology. There's no adaptive AI tutor, no billion-dollar ed tech platform. It's phonics, attendance, and more time. The tools are old. The commitment to actually using them is what's new. The comments reveal the real tension, though. Someone pointed out the obvious. Take money from administrative salaries. Pay teachers more. Fund breakfast programs. The interventions that work aren't mysterious. They're just inconvenient for the people who control the budgets. Alabama stumbled into something. Whether anyone else picks it up, that's the question worth watching. So what happens when you give people tools and trust them to show up? Story 5. Mini Darium, pause. An encrypted local cross-platform journaling app. AES are we all JCMO. AES are we all K-files. Are going to key their revision. EZDH followed by HKDF. This is a journaling app. Let that land for a second. Someone built the kind of cryptographic stack you'd expect in a secure messaging protocol. and they pointed it at your diary. And the whole thing is open source, built with Tori, SolidJS, and Rust, sitting on GitHub for anyone to read, audit, or fork. The detail worth noticing is the wrapped master key design. A random key encrypts all your entries, your password, or your key file, or both. They don't touch the entries directly. They unwrap the master key into memory for the session. Adding a new authentication method means wrapping the master key one more time. Removing one means dropping that wrap. No re-encryption of your entire journal. That's an O of one operation, which means the system scales without ever touching your data again after it's written. That's not a journaling feature. That's a proper key management architecture. The origin story matters here. This is a spiritual successor to Mini Diary by Samuel Muley, an app that did the simple, private, local, only thing well until its dependencies aged out. The original developer stopped maintaining it. The new developer didn't fork it, didn't try to patch the rock, started from scratch with a modern stack, Tori 2 instead of Electron, SolidJS instead of React, Rust on the back end instead of Node. One commenter asked the hard question, how do you access your diary when the developer stops maintaining this one too? And that's where the architecture answers a question the developer didn't have to. It's ACWall Lite on disk. It's AES-256-GCM with documented key derivation. The encryption isn't proprietary. If this app disappears tomorrow, your data is still yours. And anyone with the spec can write a decryptor. Compare that to every cloud journal that holds her thoughts hostage behind a subscription. Zero network access, no telemetry, no analytics, no update checks. The app doesn't even know the internet exists. In an era where every notes app wants to sync to someone's server, this thing treats the network like a threat surface, which is exactly what it is. This is bootstrapism at its most personal. The tools to keep your own thoughts private, running on your own machine with cryptography you can verify. No one standing between you and your own mind. Moving on. Imagine if someone told you in 2026 that the most exciting publication in computing fits every article on a single page. You'd think it was a gimmick, a constraint for constraint's sake. Run that forward, though. What does a one-page limit actually do to technical writing? It kills padding. It murders throat clearing. Every word has to earn its place. You can't hide behind a 20-page preamble before getting to the point. And what you end up with is something that feels genuinely like the best of Byte Magazine and Dr. Dobbs' journal. Dense, playful, deeply technical, and written by people who care more about the craft than the word count. Page Out Issue 8 just dropped, and the comments tell you everything. People aren't skimming it. They're setting the cover art as their desktop wallpaper. They're pulling threads on query-based compiler architectures because a single page mentioned it in passing, and they had to know more. One commenter suspects the PDF itself might be a polyglot. A file that's simultaneously valid as multiple formats. That's not a publication. That's a love letter to the hacker ethos, written in the medium itself. Let me steelman the case against this. Physical magazines died for a reason. PDF is a terrible reading experience on phones. The one-page constraint means you can never go deep enough. A real technical paper needs space for proofs, benchmarks, methodology. And every one of those objections misses the point entirely. Paged Out isn't competing with academic journals. It's competing with doom scrolling. It's asking whether you can spark curiosity in 60 seconds of reading, and the answer, 8 issues in, is obviously yes. The whole thing is free, Creative Commons licensed. No paywall, no institutional access required. No login, they've even built a web viewer now so you don't need a PDF reader. The knowledge is just sitting there waiting for anyone who wants it. This is what open culture looks like when it's not trying to be a movement. It's just people making things and putting them where others can reach them. A one-page article on compiler design that sends someone down a rabbit hole they didn't know existed. That's the bootstrap. Not a manifesto. A PDF that might also be something else entirely, if you look at it right. 7 stories in, and we're just getting started. Let's talk about what happens when 2 programming languages decide to actually cooperate. Postgres as a job queue. It's one of those ideas that sounds like a hack until you realize it's actually the correct architectural choice for most teams. Open has been the gold standard for background jobs in Elixir for years now. What's new here is that Open for Python was built from day one to share the same jobs table, same schema, same JSON args, same queue semantics. An Elixir app writes a row. A Python worker picks it up. A Python app writes a row. An Elixir worker picks it up. The bridge is just a database table. Let's talk about what this replaces. The conventional wisdom says you need a message broker. RabbitMQ, Redis, Kafka, if you're feeling ambitious. Each one is another service to deploy, monitor, and debug at 3 a.m. when it decides to partition. Each one is another protocol, another client library, another failure mode. And for what? To move a JSON blob from point A to point B. Open says you already have Postgres. You already trust it with your data. Your ops team already knows how to back it up, replicate it, and keep it running. Why add another moving part? The demo they built is a conference badge generator. Elixir enqueues jobs with attendee data. Python picks them up and renders PDFs with Wheezy print. The worker declaration on the Python side is about 10 lines. The Elixir side fires off a batch insert. Both sides maintain independent cluster leadership, so they're not fighting over locks. They coordinate through the jobs table and through Postgres PubSub for real-time notification. Now, the architectural question worth asking. Oban Pro, the commercial layer, is proprietary. The core Oban library for Elixir is open source, Apache licensed. Oban for Python is also open source. But the web dashboard, the advanced features, the cross-language orchestration tooling. That's the paid tier. It's a fair trade. The protocol is open. The table schema is open. The core libraries are open. If Oban the company disappeared tomorrow, your jobs table still works. You could write your own consumer in any language that speaks Postgres. That's the right way to build commercial developer tools. Open protocol, open data format, proprietary convenience layer. The lock-in is in the polish, not the plumbing. Your data never leaves a system you control. For teams running Elixir and Python side by side, which is increasingly common as ML workloads get bolted onto web applications. This is the simplest possible bridge. No new infrastructure. No new protocols. Just rows in a table. Moving on. In Knowing Dollars and Valiant Sound, the SA chip specification is a public document. Any hobbyist with $20 and a soldering iron could understand exactly how their machine made sound. That decision, to publish rather than protect, created a music scene that's still producing original work 44 years later. The same logic applies to what's happening here with Sea Wolves, a brand new commercial game for the Commodore 64, released in 2026, and the developer has done something genuinely wonderful. They published a detailed technical breakdown of every trick in the game. The techniques are wild, NMIs and IRQs running in synchronization. Using the non-maskable interrupt as a safety net, so that if one of your 7 interrupt handlers stalls, the corruption only spreads to the bottom of the screen before the next frame resets everything cleanly. That's not just clever engineering. That's defensive systems design on a machine with 64 kilobytes of RAM. Then there are splites. Sprites, where you replace the graphic data in real time as the raster beam moves down the screen. So a single hardware sprite becomes a tall vertical column of arbitrary pixel data. The developer uses this for torpedoes. One hardware sprite, rewritten scanline by scanline, producing a visual element that shouldn't be possible within the VIC-C's 8 sprite limit. The water distortion effect uses FLD. Forest line crunch. To shift raster lines downward, then corrects upward with DMA suppression. The ocean literally ripples using nothing but precisely timed register manipulations. No frame buffer, no blitting. Just a conversation between the CPU and the video chip, measured in clock cycles. What question is nobody asking? Why is a 42-year-old processor still producing work that surprises people? Because the documentation was public. Because the hardware was understandable. Because when you give people complete knowledge of a system, they will find things in it that the designers never imagined. Every one of these techniques was discovered by hobbyists reading datasheets and testing theories. The machine didn't change. The understanding deepened. This blog post is itself an act of publishing. Putting the tricks where others can reach them, exactly like Commodore did with that said chip spec. The cycle continues. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. From hardware tricks to rendering light itself, PauseBuilt Story 9 takes us to a GPU ray tracer built entirely in Julia. When I was building rendering pipelines, there was always this moment. You'd get your simulation data looking perfect in the interactive viewer, and then someone would ask for a publication quality image. And suddenly, you're exporting OBJ files, learning Blender, fighting with material systems that have nothing to do with your actual data. It's like being fluent in French and then being told to write your paper in Mandarin. Same ideas, completely different tooling. That's the gap Makey just closed. Ray Makey and Hikari bring physically based path, tracing directly into Julia's Makey visualization ecosystem. Same API you already use. Same scene graph. Same camera controls. You just swap the back end, and suddenly, you've got global illumination, volumetric media, spectral rendering, the full photorealistic pipeline. No export step, no context switch. Think of it like what happened when compilers got good enough that you stopped writing assembly. The capability was always there, but the friction made it impractical for most people. This is that moment for scientific visualization. The engineering underneath deserves attention. Hikari is a Julia port of PBRTB4. The canonical reference implementation from Farr, Jakob, and Humphreys. A wavefront volumetric path tracer with spectral rendering, participating media via nano-VDB sparse grids, physically based materials, and it runs on the GPU through kernelabstractions.jl, which means a single codebase targets AMD, NVIDIA, and CPU. The comments notice something unusual. This was developed AMD first. ROCm support isn't the afterthought. It's the primary target. That's quietly significant. When your ray tracer works on AMD first and NVIDIA second, you're building for the hardware landscape as it actually exists. Not as one vendor's marketing department wishes it did. The cloud rendering showcase with O'Shane Nanig. GPU accelerated ocean and atmosphere simulation feeding directly into photorealistic volumetric path tracing. That's ClimeIt researchers seeing their LES data rendered with physically accurate light scattering. No intermediate tools. No lossy exports. Data to image in one language, one ecosystem. Julia's multiple dispatch makes the whole architecture extensible. Custom materials, custom integrators, custom media. All running on GPU, all composable. This is what a hackable ray tracer looks like. The code is available. The architecture is modular. Pull the thread. From GPU ray tracing to a medieval horseback empire, Ted, this is why I love this show. Story 10. Medieval France had a Mongol obsession, not a casual curiosity. A deep structural fascination that shaped diplomacy, literature, and even royal self-conception. French kings and chroniclers looked east at the Khans and saw something they wanted to be. An empire that ran on meritocracy and religious tolerance, administered by a postal system that moved information faster than anything Europe had built. Governing more land than Rome ever touched. The comments pull an incredible thread here. The Mughal administration in India. Descendants of that same Mongol system presided over a period with virtually no global famines. That's not military glory. That's logistics. That's governance at a scale Europe couldn't conceptualize yet. And someone mentions Ruban Bar Sama, a Christian born in Beijing, who walked to Paris as a Mongol ambassador. Let that route sink in. Beijing to Paris, overland in the 13th century. The Mongol network made that journey not just possible, but diplomatically routine. Europe's frame of reference was so narrow that encountering this kind of cosmopolitan infrastructure must have been genuinely disorienting. The first principal's question is what the French actually admired. It wasn't the conquest. They had their own conquest traditions. It was the administration, the meritocracy, the idea that you could govern a continent not through feudal blood claims, but through competence and systems. One commenter speculates it connects to France's own imperial aspirations, and that tracks. You study what you want to become. There's a pattern here that repeats across history. The most transformative ideas don't always originate where they're implemented. Sometimes they travel thousands of miles, get filtered through mythology and projection, and reshape the recipient culture more than the source. The Mongols built the system. France built the legend. Both matter. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for February 19th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quen 3. TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that outlasts its moment. We'll see you back here tomorrow.